If you're wondering what those pictures all had in common, they are all related in one way or another to Brexit. You are meeting on one of the most interesting days in London. Hopefully you'll get a little bit of time before you go home. You can just wander up to Parliament and have a look at the party that's currently going on outside the building. It's a very civilised party. All the people who want to leave are there, all the people who don't want to leave are there. They've all got their different flags, and so far nobody has hit each other, as far as I can see. I've been asked to talk to you about globalisation and how Britain fits in to the world. I'm a geographer, I draw maps, and what I'm going to show you is just over a dozen different maps of the world to help you think about these things. What you're seeing here are some book covers. I draw weird maps of the world. So I'm going to show you some strange stretch maps of the world. Britain is what I've looked at mostly for the last 30 years. The thing I'm obsessed with at the moment is Brexit, and that's the Rule Britannia book you can see up there. I should say thanks to Kirsten and Jamie, who did the video, by the way, before I forget to do that. Globalisation. You can kind of spell it different ways. And in a way, globalisation, the word, might itself be a victim of globalisation, because it's the idea that we become ever more similar around the world, ever more similar in how we speak, ever more similar in how we spell, ever more similar in terms of the shops you see on your high street. You'll see the McDonald's arches in most of the world now. You'll see fewer and fewer individual shops. It's the idea that there will be increased trade. The amount at which we're independent upon each other will rise and rise and rise. That doesn't always happen. The last peak of globalization was 1913. After 1913, when the First World War began, world trade actually shrunk dramatically. It can shrink. We're currently in the middle of a global trade war between China and the USA. It might not get worse. If it gets worse, you'll certainly know about it. And it's also the idea of a shrinking planet. How many of you have been outside of this country, abroad on holiday? Right, vast majority. When I was your age at school, only a small minority of hands would have gone up. And the most common way you would have been abroad for somebody of my age was you'd have been on a school trip. And that school trip would have been to France. But to give you an idea about how the world has changed, when I went to France, when I was your age, we could get 10 francs for every pound. That's like 10 euros for a pound. A bottle of wine cost 3 francs. So for 1 pound, you could buy, as a school child, 3 bottles of wine. Right? That's an idea of just how the world has changed. I've got less than... Actually, I've only got 22 minutes, because I'm going to make sure there's lots of time for questions. So I'm going to show you pictures. But if you're thinking about how big we are in the world, we now have less than 1% of the world's people. We have much less than 0.5% of the world's children. You are at an absolute premium. There aren't actually enough of you. There aren't enough of you to look after people like me in about 20 years' time. And that's going to change. But we're also much bigger than we think. By some estimates, 14%, 1 in 7 of all the carbon atoms that are up there helping global warming are British carbon atoms, because we dug our coal out first, earliest, and burnt most of it. And you can argue that we have a disproportionate effect on the world. Here's one of those stretch maps, just to start giving you an idea. How many of you have seen maps like this before? A few, that's good, it's encouraging. Again, these maps didn't exist 30 years ago. What the map is doing is it's taking every country and making the area proportional, in this case, the people who've got an internet connection. So you can see that China's very big, India's fairly big, but Europe is disproportionately sized. The United States actually isn't that big. Even though almost everybody's connected to the internet in the United States, there aren't that many people in the US, far less than there are in Europe. And then when you look into the middle of Africa, you'll see it's much less, but the large country is Nigeria, where the connections are relatively high. That picture is a way of summarising about 205 numbers very quickly to give you an idea. And if I was better at graphics, I'd show you the animation of that, beginning with just the US and the UK and the very first internet connections, and then watching the thing spread. Here's another picture. This is the planet you live on. This is what it looks like. You're not normally shown this picture. It isn't actually green, we just kind of made it green. But this is what the world looks like if you give everybody an equal amount of space. So this is the planet from the point of view of people. And when you draw it from the point of view of people, Europe is much smaller and it's shrinking. The last time in this country we had more than two children per family was around about, I think, 1965, 67. So for well over 50 years, we have been having fewer and fewer children, not enough children to actually replace the population. We have one of the highest fertility rates in Europe now. It was about 1.9. There's no way it's going to get to 2. The only thing that stops this country depopulating is immigration. Otherwise, we get smaller and smaller and smaller and rapidly older because immigrants tend to be younger. We've drawn some roads on that map, some of the world's roads. We've drawn the submarine cables. We put some light on it, the major trade routes. But in particular, we've drawn the path of what was the largest ship in the world a couple of years ago. This is a ship which set off in the port of Dalian in China. We're all going to have to learn about cities in China fairly soon. China's doing very well out of globalization. It's a ship that took just over 30 days to steam its way down the Chinese coast, around the bottom of India, up through the Suez Canal, through the Mediterranean, and then it came up to Rotterdam. It didn't stop in the UK because we're very small. It stopped in Rotterdam because the European market is very big. And it unloaded its containers, 20-foot containers. 20-foot containers are now the standard way in which things are moved around the world. And in a way, the creation of 20-foot containers and roll-on, roll-off ports is part of what's made the current high level of global trade possible. If you want to get an idea of globalization, very quietly and discreetly have a look at the labels in your clothes, particularly your underwear, and see where it was made. Almost all of you are wearing things that came from another country. They were not made in Britain. If you think about the food that you ate this morning, you're getting excited now. Don't get too excited about checking your underwear. It's not that. If anybody's got British underwear and they want to identify themselves, I challenge you to find any. I knew I shouldn't have mentioned the underwear. If you think about the food you ate this morning, if you had breakfast cereal, the wheat in that almost certainly came from abroad. If you think about the fuel that got you here on a coach, that fuel may have come from the North Sea, but it very probably didn't. Almost everything that you'll do today that relies on material goods has relied on trade. The electricity, which is lighting this place now, it probably comes from Britain, but it might actually be coming under the Channel Tunnel, under the channel, not actually through the tunnel, generated by nuclear power stations in France. This particular ship is one example. When the ship unloaded in Rotterdam, you put one container on the back of a lorry. If the lorries had gone out end to end, they would have been 100 kilometers long. And that's just one container. So we're in an interconnected world where things are moving around in larger amounts than ever before. We consume about 6 times more by weight than our parents. Your parents bought and used less things. They used to have little old metal dustbins, not these great big dustbins you now have. You buy far more clothes than your parents. The average item of clothing is only worn about 6 times before it's thrown away. Globalization is what makes that possible, and a kind of lack of respect for the environment. Different map. Different way of seeing the world. What we've done here is all we've done is just take the oceans out. I mean, the oceans matter, but they're not very important from the point of view of your everyday lives. And suddenly the planet looks very different. The UK isn't at the centre. There's no reason to put the United Kingdom at the centre of a map. Rich and powerful countries tend to feel the need to put themselves at the centre. If we were in the United States of America now, you would have the USA in the middle and the rest of the world around it. But this map is centred on the densest part of the population of the planet, which is in India. Just over 1 billion people in India, 1 billion people in China. If you've got very good eyesight, you can see Chongqing, it's the largest city in the world. You can see it's a city because it's kind of bulging. If you've got really good eyesight, you can see the lines of longitude and latitude. You see, they're all a bit curved, but they're still all meeting at 90 degrees. If any of you are very geeky and want to do the sociology of visualization later on if you go to university, the trick of getting all those lines to be the right size and shape so that everybody gets the right amount of space and still get them to meet at 90 degrees was quite difficult. But it's a different view of the planet. People often think that globalization makes you more unequal. Globalization makes some people very rich, but it means that other people become poorer and poorer. Because, for instance, in the case of this country, all the textiles are made abroad, so people who used to work in the mills in Lancashire and the mills in Yorkshire no longer have jobs in those factories. People who used to work in shipyards in Britain no longer have jobs because we don't have hardly any shipyards left. But some people in London are doing very well. If you look at miners, people working in mining in Britain, we used to have well over 1 million miners. Almost all mining went in the 1980s. By 1991, the highest concentration of people working in the mining industry in this country were in Stoke-on-Trent. And they were women. And they weren't going down the mine. They were actually working in the potteries with clay, and that counted as mining because of what it is. By 2001, by the 2001 census, the highest concentration of people in the mining industry in Britain was in Guildford, because Guildford's the centre for the oil exploration industry. And that's where they sit with computer models of where the oil is. The top graph here is showing the change in the take of the best off 1%. When globalization was last at its peak, around about 1913, the best off in the top is the best off 10%. The best off 10% were taking half of all of everything. 100 years ago, the big houses were full of the richest people on the planet around here. This was the center of everything. It was at the end of the British Empire. The most common job for women in the whole of the country was to work in service, to be a servant. That's what a very unequal country is like. And then after the First World War and after the Second World War, inequalities fell. And you can see that red line going down as the take of the top 10% reduced and reduced and reduced down to a minimum of just over a quarter. So the best off 10% having a quarter of everything by the beginning of the 1980s. And then we became more and more unequal. So now we're back at roughly the best off 10% taking 40% of all income. That leaves 60% for 9 out of 10 people. I won't get any more boring than that over these numbers. It just kind of gives you an idea. But that rise, that huge rise in the red graph, wasn't seen anywhere else in Europe as starkly. There are countries in Europe, Switzerland and the Netherlands, where it actually fell. The bars at the bottom are part of a much larger graph, but I'm only showing you the countries that fail. The larger graph includes almost all of Europe, Korea, Japan. It's a comparison of different OECD countries. The OECD is the club of the rich countries of the world, has just over 50 members. And the graph is showing you the most unequal countries in the OECD. The most unequal is Mexico, then Chile, then Turkey. They tend to be countries with a high degree of violence. In the case of Turkey, in effect, countries run by a dictator. The next most unequal is the United States, not quite run by a dictator, but the US is still not a very happy country. I hope if you're studying sociology, that the sociology curriculum now explains that it is in the United States of America that the highest proportions of people on the planet are imprisoned, has the worst crime rates in the rich world. One in 13 black women in cities is evicted from their property every year. The United States has the worst infant mortality, it has declining life expectancy. It is a wreck of a country. It is not doing very well. And then after the United States, we got a small Baltic state, Lithuania, and then we have Russia. Russia is a very, very unequal country now. There are people involved with the gas and oil industry who are very rich, people close to the government who are very rich, but many people living in poverty, particularly outside of Moscow. And then right next to Russia, almost as unequal as Russia, is the United Kingdom. So you're living in a very, very unequal country. It's not due to globalization, because all the other countries of Europe are more equal than you are. But it has happened. And then, slightly more equal than the UK, is Israel. And that's Israel including the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. But we actually have wider income inequalities than Israel. This is a weird country. And part of what we're discovering at the moment is our weirdness. Here's another one of these maps. In this case, the map is only of the British Empire. But I say only because the British Empire was about a quarter of the population of the planet. It was the biggest empire the world has ever known. If you're wondering why you're sitting in this building, this enormous, very expensive building, the Methodists didn't just manage to build it because they collected money from the streets in boxes. There was another source of cash. All around here, you're looking at buildings in the middle of London that were built from the monies made from the empire. The empire, in a way, was a form of globalization. But it was a form of globalization where people didn't have much choice over whether they took part. If you've got good eyesight, you can see the dates at which countries were, in effect, invaded and made to join the empire. And you can see the dates at which they won their freedom, often violently. We don't tend to teach much about the British Empire in our schools. I hope we will do. If you were children in China, you would all know, because you'd all be taught in your schools about what the British did to China. So I just might as well tell you now. We wanted more. We wanted to build more halls like this. We wanted more money. And when you get an empire that gets bigger and bigger, it gets harder to get more. But we owned India. And one thing you can do in India is you can grow the opium poppy. So we grew a lot of opium. But we needed somebody to buy our opium. So we took our opium on ships through Hong Kong into China. And when the Chinese said they didn't want it, we took battleships. And we forced them to buy the opium and destroyed the Chinese civilization by flooding China with opiates. The full story is really rather horrific, so we don't go into much detail about it, but just think. The textiles, the clothes you're no longer wearing. When Britain was dominating textiles in the world, we did it by taking people from Africa, taking them forcibly by ship to the Americas, making them pick cotton in the Americas, taking that cotton back over to England, weaving it into goods in Manchester, and then destroying the textile industry of places like India so they had to buy our cotton goods. If you go to New Zealand today, and you go to a supermarket and you're wanting to buy a bed sheet, the word above the shelf in New Zealand is Manchester. It actually says Manchester instead of linen. So we have a huge legacy of what we were involved in, and this might matter for what happens next. The picture there is of Hong Kong, which got its independence, sort of independence, in 1997. It kind of left one empire and joined another. This is the history of immigration, as best that we know it in the UK. If you were American school children, you would be sick of seeing graphs and images like this, because the Americans celebrate their immigrant status. And on the American census form, you get to say where all your grandparents were born. This is data from the 1841 census all the way through to 2011. And it's showing the number of people in Britain at any one time who are born abroad and where they were born abroad. And you can see particular accelerations. And at each period of acceleration, there were concerns. So some of the very first images in that video were images about trying to stop Jewish people coming into the country around about 1905, when the British Union of Fascists was formed, and we tried to close the borders because we were worried about what would happen if lots of Jewish people turned up here. A bit later, when I was a child, the government was trying to stop people coming over from the Caribbean. It first of all invited them, and then it tried to stop them, and we changed Acts of Parliament. The latest debacle is all about people from Eastern Europe. We opened up to Eastern Europe first, we chose to, and then we complained about people coming from Eastern Europe. This isn't, it may look dramatic to you, but I can show you another graph where we actually put the full 64 million on, and it's very small, and it's not unusual by European standards. How many of you have got a grandparent who was born outside Britain? That's one. Yeah, you can tell this is London. Yeah, say hi. If I did up in the north, it goes much lower. But how many have got a great-grandparent? Should be higher. Okay. Not many more of these maps to go, so please start thinking of questions. This is a map of Europe. Again, we stretch the map so that everybody gets an equal amount of space. The areas coloured yellow are where less than 5% of people were born abroad. And that's what I mean about the north. If you look at the north, you'll see less than 5%. 95% of people born in the UK. There are hardly any immigrants in the north of England. The area coloured dark blue is more than a fifth. Only here, really, in England, west central London, are more than a fifth of people born outside the UK. It's higher in Ireland, because if you're born in the south of Ireland and you move to the north, you've crossed the border. But it's highest in Switzerland. And it's very high in much of the centre of Europe. People move around. Immigration's actually higher. One of the highest rates, don't know if I've got a little pointer. Oh, yeah, just here. That's the Mediterranean coast of Spain. And if you're wondering who the immigrants are in the Mediterranean coast of Spain, they're people from quite a lot of countries, but one country in particular dominates, and that's England. We have hundreds of thousands of old English people living down in the coast of Spain. Depending how it goes over the next few weeks and months, you might get to meet some of them because they're not going to get free healthcare anymore. Anyway, the point of this is just to show you we're not all coloured blue. This isn't a country that's been flooded by immigration. It's a country with enormous inequalities. The map you're looking here is a map of who pays inheritance tax. All the grey areas, nobody in a year who died paid inheritance tax. The largest is the city of Hull. Not a single person in one year in Hull paid inheritance tax. But the remarkable thing is very near here, you've got the highest rates, Kensington and Chelsea. But even there, it's only 17% of people in Kensington and Chelsea who pay inheritance tax. Partly because they've got good accountants and they work out how to avoid it. But I just wanted to give you an image. That's how the country is divided. Most of you, most of your parents will never be rich enough to pay inheritance tax. Some of them will think they've got a house that's worth a lot of money. Might have a house they think is worth 600, 700, 800,000 pounds, maybe a million. But what your parents are not thinking about is who's going to buy it from them, because they need somebody who can borrow that much money to be able to buy it. Here's a European map of poverty. And again, London has all that wealth, but you can see from here it also has the greatest concentration of poverty in Western Europe as well. London is a quite remarkable place at the moment. Poverty rates that are similar to the bottom half of Italy, to Greece, actually to Istanbul. We have the greatest regional inequalities in all of Europe. This graph was drawn by The Economist magazine. The Economist magazine is not a radical publication, but sociologically it's fascinating. This is really interesting. Can you imagine how boring it would be to be studying society in Sweden, where kind of everything works? You know, you all go to the same state schools, there's nothing to moan about. London is exciting. There's no chance of Sweden leaving the EU. In fact, there's no chance of anywhere leaving the EU. The one great thing we've done is we've shown how impossible it is to leave the EU. But you're lucky. You're lucky. You're living in the most unequal city, in the most unequal country, at the most unequal time for a century. From the point of view of sociology, this is perfect. The only problem is you've got to live the rest of your life as well. And things are changing. Currently, they're debating High Speed 2. High Speed 2 is one little railway line to Birmingham that splits in two. This is one of many train yards in China. Right. It's really worth going to see China now. It is very different. Right. We have an idea which is kind of outdated about what is going on. And other things change. I don't know. I'm a boring old fart. But when I saw this sign on a train, I thought, do we really have to tell people that they need to think about other people? I mean, how slow have we got? And it's related to inequality and globalization. There's a lovely test that's done where you ask people, would you leave your bag on a seat on a train when you went to the toilet or not? Now, most of you wouldn't. You go, no, it'd be nicked. Test it out with a bag with nothing in. I can promise you, it will almost never be nicked. But if you ask people in Sweden that question, most people will say, yeah. And they won't even ask the person opposite to keep an eye on it. Different countries are very, very different. The little map is a map of wilderness, by the way. If you ever want to get away from it all, that's where you need to go. Almost at the end. I thought I should put something in about meat and about sustainability. So this is the planet drawn in proportion to people who eat too much meat. Who's a vegan or a vegetarian? Yeah, go on, be proud. Hiya, go for it. You're from London, it should be much bigger. Okay, hands down. Just one prediction for you. If you're gonna remember one thing, most of you will have children. Most of you will have children, and I'm willing to bet that most of your children will be vegetarian. Yeah, let's see. You're going, never. I'm going to make them eat meat. I'm running out of time. One slide on Brexit. This is the estimate of which countries are going to be most affected by Brexit after the UK. The estimate was produced 2 weeks before the poll, and the most effective countries are Ireland, Malta, Luxembourg, Cyprus, Switzerland, Belgium. The important thing to know is that they're all small and they don't matter. And that's why the negotiations have been so hard, because despite the fact we're a globalised world, we're not very important to France or Germany or Spain or Italy. This is a really hard lesson we're learning at the moment. Apparently the vote tomorrow has been cancelled. Theresa's getting on a plane and going to beg. It's embarrassing. It's interesting to see. Only one more slide after this. And again, showing you differences in countries. We are the country which least protests in Europe. Only 15% of adults in this country have ever been on a protest. How many of you have been on a protest? Good. We've not quite got up to 15% yet. Some of the adults have. Teachers are good for protesting. The next most boring country to us in Europe is Germany. But twice as many Germans have ever been on a protest. If you watch the news of the last couple of days, you'll see how they protest in France. They really know how to protest in France. If you do get the chance to walk past Parliament this afternoon, it's very nice that it's civilized, but it is quite remarkable just how civilized that protest is. And a final image, last one for you to think about. This is the same map as I showed you with the ship going round it. But in this case, what I've done is put up the Earth at night image. Now, you'll have all seen this image before, but you've seen it on a normal map. And when you see that image on a normal map, what you think you're seeing is where people are, but you're not. What you're seeing is where people are who are willing to waste light. On this map of the world, there's exactly the same number of people living in every single pixel. Exactly the same number. So if there's light shining up, it means that you've got people who are rich enough, who have got enough spare oil to be able to burn electricity and send it up to space so that a satellite can take a picture. The areas without light are not areas without electricity. Almost all the world has electricity now. They're areas where people don't waste electricity, and so they're not shining light up into the sky at night. Thank you very much for your patience. Please. Oh.